Do you want to help your children learn about true history, personal freedom, responsibility, and individual rights? Then check out the Tuttle Twins books through my link. We read these books often, and I'm always impressed at how they bring these big concepts down to a place a kid can understand. Even I'm learning as I read. Like book number 4, Food Truck Fiasco, in the ages 5 through 11 series, the Tuttle Twins have a lemonade stand, and through real-life context, they learn what regulations the government puts on their neighbor with a food truck. The book explains how many laws and rules are put in place to help big companies hurt their competition. Grab my link in the show notes, TuttleTwins.com/REF/CHERYL, and use code Cheryl40 for 40% off all products for kids ages 5 through 11. That's TuttleTwins.com/REF/CHERYL and code CHERYL40 for 40% off. Do you want to homeschool but are overwhelmed with where to start? My Homeschool Village knows this and has you covered. In episode 13, I chat with Becky, co-creator of My Homeschool Village. Instead of us parents paying for membership from this app and that curriculum, what Becky did is contact the company for each product and bargained for a group rate. With My Homeschool Village, you pay one monthly fee and get access to all the best apps and curriculum like Type-C, IXL, Starfall, Creative Bug, Education.com. There's even Minecraft classrooms, electives, science clubs, book clubs, courses on homesteading, herbal remedies, survival skills, plus a network of support for you, the parents. It takes a village to raise a child, and My Homeschool Village is here for you. And if you sign up with my code, you get 50% off your first year. Go to myhomeschoolvillage.com and use code HOW250, H-O-W-250, for 50% off of your first year. Check me out on my show notes or my Instagram or Facebook page, and you can get the link and code right there. Welcome to this week's episode of The Homeschool How-To. I'm Cheryl, and I invite you to join me on my quest to find out, why are people homeschooling? How do you do it? How does it differ from region to region? And should I homeschool my kids? Stick with me as I interview homeschooling families from all over to help me unfold the answers to each of these questions week by week. Welcome. With us today, we have Teresa from the Kootenai Mountains of British Columbia. Welcome, Teresa. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, and hello, everybody.
Let's start by having you tell us how many kids you have and what ages they are.
Yes. Okay, so I have 4 kids. My oldest is 22, then 20, almost 18, and 14 and a half. Hard to believe I'm saying that out loud. It feels like I'm back where you were.
Yeah, I'm sure it goes by so quick.
It really does.
So tell us, what got you into the homeschooling world?
Yeah. Okay, so for me, I remember meeting, getting to know an unschooling family, and me thinking, there ain't no way I'm doing that. That can't be right. And so probably within a couple months, we were on a vacation. I had an afternoon to do what I wanted, which almost never happened with me and my 3 little girls at the time. And I remember going into a bookshop, looking at this one book called Is Homeschooling the Right Path for You or something? And I remember thinking, definitely not. And so then I want to read this book. So I have my arguments against it because it seemed like a lot of people were doing it. Not a lot of people like in the last few years, but a lot more people around me. And so I'd get my arguments against it. And within the week, I was sold. We were going to homeschool.
Oh my goodness. First of all, I think that's amazing that you were like, let me read this book to get my arguments against it. Because if anything we've seen in the last few years, people will not research the other side. They only take talking points from one area. And it's like, you need to research to know why you're against it. That is such a great thing to even pass on to your kids as part of schooling. That's something we should all remember. What was it about homeschooling that lured you in?
So many things, but the things that kept me doing it, it might have been rooted in the same values, but it really just expanded. I kept realizing, whoa, there's even more reasons. Originally, it was Well, probably it was six different things, but I'll just throw one word. It's freedom. That was the real root word that I was focusing on. And there was freedom for my kids to learn the way that they could learn or would learn. And had I learned with freedom, had I learned in a way that really served who I am and what I needed in life? No, not really. And so there was that. And then there were all these other things, like my kids were in a private school at the time. Kindergarten and grade two was their final years, the oldest two. And at that point, I could see that it was fine, but it wasn't serving them any more than I could be at home. And what they were learning was okay. They had some lovely teachers, some not so lovely experiences. And yet I was like, well, why am I spending so much time bringing kids back and forth and signing permission forms and, you know, all the things, bringing homework home? Why can't they do that in 8 hours of the day? What's up with that? They're grade two, like she was grade two. And then it just kind of all came together where I realized we could have a very free lifestyle to go travel, to really just live life on our own terms. So if I can remember back that many years, which I can't even remember how many years I've been doing this. So, but it was a long time ago. That was the energy, was freedom.
That's awesome. Where did you even start with curriculums back then? Because now if I feel like there's curriculum everywhere you turn, which almost makes it a little harder because it's like, which one's the right one? And oh, try a little of this, a little of that. And like that gets overwhelming. Where did you start with curriculum?
And expensive. Yeah. Well, I would say that I spent 2 years researching. So I'm like you. I didn't do a podcast, but I did do the full, like, search every possible rabbit trail. How should I do this? What's the right philosophy? What are the right, you know, books, or what are my children's learning styles? I did all the things. And I don't think you need 2 years to do it, by the way. I think you can just jump right in and not even think about curriculum. That's what I really think. But you will, because that's what we do in the beginning. And I spent too much money in the box or out of the box curriculum that really could have been like a full-time private school. Like they do more curriculum in that out of the box curriculum than probably they do in a homeschool or in a private school. So I started with that. And then I realized I'm probably going to use this stuff forever, which is true because I still have some of it unused and I'm at the tail end of my homeschool journey.
Oh, that's awesome. So how old is your oldest?
22. So she's
done with school. Yeah. Did she go on to post-education?
She's doing that still.
Yeah. How did that transition work for her?
Which part?
Just going from learning at home to maybe now being in an institution, having more of a regimented way to do things, or, you know, was it easy for her or hard to be around all these people?
Nah, not at all. She was very social and also is my third is very social too. Really what I saw, none of them had a problem going into a system and here's systematized learning and here's the expectations, because I'd already had an environment where we were purposefully learning things. And at times, not necessarily just with curriculum or routines, but I had expectations of them, like you need to treat each other kindly, or I'd like you to do the dishes, or, you know, in a way it's a system. It's a very different system. The family is more connected and attached than a school ever would be. And as parents, we always have very distinct reasons why we're doing what we're doing in our home. Whereas sometimes the institution isn't quite like that. But so they're accustomed to that. They could go right into the academic element, no problem. The social element, they were ready. They were eager for it. But one common theme that I hear, each of the three oldest, my third daughter is about to graduate high school. I see with each of them that they don't understand when they are in a formal setting or in a brick and mortar type setting, why things have to be done the way they're done. And they don't see the value in it. They don't see it. And I hear that in varying ways from each of them, but each of them are like, yeah, this doesn't serve me, so why am I doing this? Which is not what a typical experience is coming out of school as another adult. As an 18 or 19 year old, we just say, well, was I good enough? You know, the school marked me good enough or not good enough based on their rubric of how I should show up or test or all the things. And whereas for them, they saw it as, is this serving me?
Yes. What are you, I mean, we want them to question that, right? That's kind of the reason that we homeschool, you know, do things that serve you, ask questions, think about it with, you know, some sort of discernment. Is this for a logical reason? Okay, do you want me to put this mask over my face because it makes sense or because it has a reason? So, I mean, that must be kind of, how do you even navigate that with the kids? Like, well, do it anyway, but, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you don't really have to? That's kind of interesting.
No, you know what? It's funny that you say that, because I do understand where people are coming from when they say, well, let's try to make the system work for us if I put my kids back into school. I think when they're doing that, it has value to say, we don't have to, it doesn't have to be this way. Having said that, it feels to me like sometimes people that do are approaching it that way, they're trying to push against Titanic and keep the Titanic from hitting the iceberg. And you're the one of 30 people or 100 or 6,000, it doesn't matter. You're not going to push that Titanic away from hitting the iceberg. And so I don't think we can change the institution. I shouldn't say I don't think we can. I think somebody can. I don't have the fortitude to try to push against an institution established like that. So that wouldn't be my goal. And so I have said to them, yes, I understand why you see what you see, and here's how you can approach it. You don't have to agree to everything. You can say, hey, this doesn't work for me, which they do without even asking my input in that. They instinctively do. Can we do things differently? Or can I not take the test on this day? Or can I do it in this form or whatever? However, I think we still show respect, and because we're human to human, not because we're a child to an institution. They're also teachers that are humans. And so then engage them respectfully. And if you want to approach things in, say, a post-secondary training, you can just see that you're checking off the boxes so that you can achieve the thing that you want in the end. Also, you can, you know, do the thing because this is going to earn you the medical degree or the whatever. And you can approach it that way. But you could also take on the entire institution if you so chose.
Absolutely. Okay, so have you found curriculums that you've liked better than others? Or did you do any sort of unschooling approach? I know you said that at a certain point you kind of found that you didn't even need a curriculum.
Well, I've really approached, first of all, as a life coach in the homeschool community, I almost never have a conversation about curriculum. Because I think curriculum can be found everywhere, and I definitely don't think there's one right curriculum for either of your kids. Like, if you have more than one, you'll discover they don't learn the same way, they don't care about the same things, certain modes are useful for them, and some are definitely not. And that's the same for you as the mom who's facilitating, or as the dad, but as the parent facilitating the education, it's different. You are approaching the learning differently too. So I actually think that you really don't have to spend a ton of money on curriculum. And I have had many experiences with curriculum that were favorable, and at different seasons, there's just some that just really didn't work. I approached my homeschooling initially like I was a private school at home. And I found that fun, and I learned a lot. And I think my kids learned a lot too. But in some ways, it was sort of a form of self-torture, trying to force the kids to sit down at a certain time. And here's how you're going to learn, and here's how we're going to approach it. Because after a while, I didn't think it was fun. It wasn't fun trying to insist that a child do a certain amount of work for a certain amount of time. And here's the important stuff that has to be done today. Especially, I was convinced when I would watch my kids go away from the homeschool table or the kitchen table and then go do their own thing. And I'd realize what they were doing, their own thing, was still learning. And it was just packaged differently than what I had put in front of them. And so then, you know, even I sometimes go, I can't believe that I actually approached it that way, because I have 6 years post-secondary school. My husband has graduate homeschool, sort of. He's a medical doctor, so he's done graduate work as well. So, you know, even when I hear myself speak like this, I think, well, that's a bit out of the box, except that it worked. And that's what I ask homeschool parents. Is it working for you? Is it working for your homeschool kids? And what do you believe in education to be anyway? because that will deeply influence how you're approaching everything.
Yeah, I think as someone starting out in it, a lot of us parents are thinking, okay, what does my child need to know by the end of kindergarten? What do they need to know by the end of third grade? What do they need to know by the end of, you know, and so on. So, and there really isn't a list somewhere. I know that there are some curriculums that, or, you know, helpful websites that say this is what you could or should, but it is not a set in stone. This is what they have to know. And I'm sure what kids are learning or exposed to in America is very different than what they're learning in British Columbia or in Europe, you know? So it's like, of course there's not one set thing. And it's not like, you know, at the end of ninth grade, the state is coming in yet saying, your kid doesn't know this, well, we're taking them away. You know, they're going to fail in life. It's not. Yeah. It's just what we want to. So I think listening to you talk and saying that, you know, they're doing things on their own, which are learning too, and you can always expand on that, maybe helps take some of the pressure off on, are we doing enough? What do we need to do? It's such a fine line between.
It really does.
Yeah, like hitting this.
It not only takes the pressure off, but it's also real. The kids are born learning animals, or they're born learning people. It's what they were born to do. And we have been told that we have to have a teacher, a lecture, tests, grades, all the things in order for kids to learn. And I do understand it's a mode, and I'm not saying it's not a place to learn, but it's not the only way to learn. Kids do automatically learn stuff. And you as a mom, a mother teacher, I say, before the age of 5, you've taught them a ton of things. You just didn't see it in a school curriculum. So therefore, you may not have registered that you are their mother teacher. You taught them how to, you know, tie their shoes. I don't know about kids in your area. They can't go into kindergarten unless they know how to tie their shoes and wipe their bums, you know, actually have been potty trained. And I'm not, maybe they're not asking for the checklist of, do you do this? But I have been asked those questions. And if you don't have that capacity, then they're not independent in kindergarten or grade one. So you as the mom are teaching those things and many things. But by the time they are, I don't know, is it 3 or 4 or 5, something like that, developmentally, they have learned so much and their brain has expanded so much. And you didn't put them in a school. Well, you might have if you're in a certain parts of the world, but yeah, probably what not
is,
in our country.
Okay, so tell me about that. What is it like in British Columbia? Like, what's the standard time that a kid would typically go into school or daycare before and after school? What is it like there?
Well, I would say it depends. You know, there is... you know, if there's two people working in the home, or there is a single parent that's working in the home, then maybe kids would go into daycare early on, very dependent on, you know, what the family is. But then definitely by 5, kindergarten is your typical entry point. 5 and full day kindergarten.
Most, if you have a two parent households, are mostly both parents working? That's typical.
You know, I think it is. And my experience, because I'm surrounded with homeschool families, I'm not able to give you a true answer to that, but I believe
true. I feel like, especially where I, you know, work in the workplace, it's many women there and many women around the, you know, that have young kids. Yeah. So the only moms I know that stay home are the ones I've met in the homeschooling community. You know, I have yet to really meet moms that just stay home while their kids are in school. Yeah. But so tell me about what you do as a life coach.
Yeah. So I serve the women in the homeschool community really as a life coach. I can talk about deschooling. That's one of the elements that differentiates me as a homeschool life coach. I talk about deschooling, or I know how to engage new homeschool families or homeschool families that are disillusioned for various reasons. So that might be their own big emotions, because as moms, we're often encouraged to look at kids, their emotional regulation, and say, how do we help them? How do we help deal with their emotional regulation? And I don't know about you, but I wasn't taught emotional regulation as a kid wasn't a word that we used or words that we used. And in my home, there wasn't a, hey, how you feeling? And so now we're in our generation. I think it's beautiful that we're asked to look at our kids and say, okay, why are they feeling what they're feeling? It means something. And so then to address them as a whole person and say, let's address your emotions and care about that. Except that we haven't been taught how to do that. So I often engage homeschool moms how to create a plan around your big emotions. And another element is building boundaries. And, you know, the energy that we expend in being in relationships that are not as healthy as they could be, or even mentally, internally planning, how do we address, you know, great Aunt Mary and her negative conversation about the homeschool thing at Thanksgiving? How do we address those boundary breaking moments? And so I discuss that. I also, and this is one of my favorite places to be, is to really be with a mother and really say, okay, who are you beyond the homeschool mom role? And what's your purpose for being here on the planet outside of mother role? Which, if you knew me way back in the day, I didn't think beyond mom. I always wanted to be a mom, put it in my high school yearbook. And I always wanted to do that. So I didn't actually imagine my life after. And eventually, as a mother, especially as a homeschool mom, you discover there's an identity outside the homeschool mom role.
It's easy to get, you know, so absorbed when you're the homeschool mom. That's been your whole life. It's not like,
even as a mom,
when your kid goes off to school, you have that, you know, mourning period that, you know, you're not needed as much and this and that. But I can imagine as a homeschooling mom, first of all, they've been with you, you know, 365 days a year, 7 days a week, and your job is to educate them. You're their sole educator. So that's got to be, I mean, you still have kids left in the home now, right? But how does it feel? Mm-hmm. Is there a mourning period, and how do you get through it?
Oh, there is. There really is. It's something that people don't talk about enough, I think. In my my Patreon support group, I was sharing a picture of one of our last summers together with me and my four kids. And I knew in the moment that this photo was taken that this was going to be one of the last moments of this part of our lives together. And it's different when you know, my oldest went to high school in grade 10, into a regular high school. And that was such a big shift for our family. But then, you know, my second unschooled high school, and she's now also across the country in her post-secondary school. And then my third is about to graduate. And every single time, it feels like this is supposed to be the way it is. Maybe I want to sign up for my kids playing, Atari. Oh my gosh, that dates me. But games in the basement until they're 25, because I've might be okay with that now. It really is hard to adjust to. And did I just say Atari?
I know what you're talking about, though. I had a Nintendo, but I do know what Atari is.
I mean, PS4. I'm pretty sure my 14-year-old boy would be like, did you say Atari?
Is that when you got into the life coaching? Because kind of like, oh my goodness, I have all this knowledge.
No.
I want to help other moms out with this and, you know, find a way to still keep homeschooling as part of your life.
Yeah, no, it was never a direct arrow. In fact, when I look back, like before I was a mom, I was an RN, a registered nurse. And that's the part of nursing that I loved. I didn't like the policy and procedure manual. I didn't like the institutional way of approaching things. Mm-hmm. Surprise. And I loved the people stuff and really helping them to manage their emotions for various reasons, or really just helping to clarify things with them about their life purpose, or really listening and being with them. So that was, it's always been who I have been. But then in 2019, I finished writing the book that I published. I've got a few, but Homeschool Mama Self-Care, Nurturing the Nurturer. And I was really writing it to myself and to other homeschool moms. And then it was to set publication for March 2020. And I remember talking to the publisher and saying, this is horrible timing to start a homeschool or to publish a homeschool
book. Might have been great.
And she's looking at me like, yeah, what? Yeah. And so then I don't know why I was thinking it that way. My world was obviously not preoccupied with homeschooling stuff. I was definitely preoccupied with all things hospital because that was our world for almost 3 years as my husband was an admin in the hospital. So I don't know why I was thinking that though, because even Ryan Reynolds was homeschooling, which I thought was pretty cool. All these popular or these well-known people in Hollywood. And so then it published in April 2020. I started podcasting a month before the pandemic was called and in my closet, and it was perfect. I naturally was that support, encouragement person for many people online, and it just gradually moved into that. But coincidentally, when you talk about wisdom and advice, even though I'm not now afraid to say what I think about all sorts of different things, that was a journey for myself to get comfortable just speaking what I truly think, even though it'll probably change in 3 years. But what I learned is that it's not about my advice as a life coach. It is me just sitting with you and helping you to speak through the things that are true inside of you so that you can meet the growth goals that you have or to overcome the challenges that you have.
That's awesome. And I'm going to be sure to put links to your book and your what is your podcast called?
Homeschool Mama Self-Care, same as the book.
Okay. We'll put links to that in the show's description so people can check that out. Now, okay, so yesterday, and this happens, I don't want to say quite often, but it happens. I'm trying to get my son ready, and I would imagine it happens a lot more when you're a homeschool parent because you're with your kids more often, right? So we're trying to get out the door, get him to his little bike group, and I have the 9-month-old baby, and she doesn't want to go in the car seat, and I'm trying to get dinner ready so that when we come home from the bike group, we can just eat, and I don't have to cook it then, and the dog's up my rear end so that I can feed him, and everything's going on at once, right? And my son's nagging at me because he wants to be defiant and doesn't want to bring a water bottle. And I'm like, it's 80 degrees here. You're bringing a water bottle. Yeah. So all this is happening and I snap at them, you know, and I just scream literally even at the 9-month-old baby. I'm like, everybody stop it, you know, and then, you know, I get up and I went over to the stove so he couldn't see me anymore. I assume he cried. I don't know. I picked up the baby in the carrier and I put her outside. Came back in. We live in a very safe place. But this obviously isn't the right thing to do. But sometimes I feel like especially when he's in these defiant, stubborn moments, he doesn't take me seriously or change until I have an explosion. So what do you have, like, coaching advice? I'm sure I'm not the only one that's ever happened to. Like, what is the best way?
No, because what you just said is a conversation I have on repeat. And I would normally unpack that kind of conversation over the course of an hour. And I want to respect the fact, I'll ask you questions, but I don't expect you to respond to them because this is in a public forum. But I would go into a discussion on, well, I could go in a variety of different ways. I would ask you, your oldest is four or six, you said. Four. Yeah. So if you wrote down your expectations of him, what would they be? And what I heard you say in that specific scenario is that you want him to take you seriously and to do the thing you want him to do. And if you remember back when you were four, do you remember that? Yeah. I think I have like two memories of three or four or something. But if you observe other 3 or 4 year olds in the playground or somewhere public, you'll see that they're just like in their own world. They're just, how do I play? I just want to play or just be in my quiet space and play by myself or play with friends. But they're not like, hey, mom, what do you want me to do? Like they're not in the taking you seriously phase, and not because they're being defiant per se, as much as that's not what they do at that age. They're not aware of you. So one of the things that I've learned for myself, and by the way, the scenario just painted, I could give you parallel stories from my own world. But what I would do is do a deep dive on child development, first of all, and say, is it actually realistic for me to expect certain things from my kids? So I would go in that direction. Because what I've learned is I can see on paper that it shouldn't be. I shouldn't be expecting that. But inside of me, I'm like, but I'm going to teach him. That's my instinct. And it's true, actually. at four, they're not capable of doing that. But if you never have the conversation of these are the things you need to do before we go out the door to do your thing, then they'll never know. So they might be 18 and you're still packing their water bottle. So there is value in creating a routine. But so you could approach that. I would say something I've learned about my own self and my journey with understanding anger is that when people are really angry, just like you experienced yesterday with your, what I call it, flooding. It's like a flooding of intensity. And you have this awareness that you don't want your 9-month-old baby to experience this moment. So you're like, okay, just put her in a safe, quiet space. And then you're not aware of what's going on with your 4-year-old or if he was crying because you're so overwhelmed by intensity. And so that's the part where I think has the most important value to explore is to say, okay, so what was going on inside of you that you immediately felt? Yeah. And also, how have your parents or your formative experiences taught you about how to approach your anger or your big emotions? How are you addressing it inside of yourself? There's a part of us that says, I should never be angry at my child. And God bless you, that ain't happening. And then also, how are you going to deal with it when the part of you that looks at the part of you that just got angry is telling that one, you're shameful, you should feel shamed, you should feel bad. You've got two parts of you that are playing out their narrative. And this one that's saying you should feel ashamed isn't useful. It doesn't serve anything. Going here and saying, I'm so sorry you felt overwhelmed by that, that your child isn't ... What are you feeling? How can I help that? How can I help you engage that scenario?
Okay, that's good. That's where it starts. All right. Well, I think that'll probably get you some people signing up for some coaching because we can really, dive into that. And so true. A lot of it has to do with us and how we handle things versus our children. Yeah.
100%. Welcome to motherhood.
Yeah. It definitely makes you. Yeah. And it's funny that you were saying how you were writing a book that was published in 2020 because when COVID actually came out, I was in Seattle, Washington for a memoir writing retreat, a one-on-one retreat, writing a memoir about my childhood and growing up with a father that had OCD, like really bad OCD. And so it was a super interesting childhood. But yes, no, we did not deal with our emotions properly. I am going to just tell you that now. So it's now as the adult being aware of that and kind of how do I want my son to approach situations without exploding like mom can get every now and then.
Yeah. And I've got one of those unpublished memoirs too. And not the same story, but ish.
Someday.
Yeah. I have the beautiful opportunity to walk alongside women in various stories, but the stories that have had those kinds of really challenging things that have kind of overwhelmed are the ones where I'm like, oh, I love walking alongside that because in a way that's walking alongside my own journey as a younger person to this point, but it is amazing watching women come from places where they think this is the way it's always going to be. This is the way I'm always going to feel. This is the way I'm always going to show up. My relationships will always be packaged this way. And then coming out of that and realizing they were the caged bird and they don't have to be. They can sing. They can do that. I don't know if you're familiar with Sarah McLachlan's song, Blackbird. Blackbird singing in the dead of night, take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. And I'm going to mess this up, but you were waiting to arise. And I love walking alongside women toward that journey.
Beautiful. Now, what would you recommend I do, say, for my son? Like, it's a day later now. Would it be beneficial to him if I went up and said, hey, mommy had some big feelings yesterday. I'm sorry I exploded. I should have reacted different. This is what I was expecting of you, you know, that sort of thing. Or is it worth it or is it just worth it to move along and change it for next time?
He's 4. So, I think it's a good practice to do that for yourself, to actually sit by him and say, I'm really sorry. I must have made you feel, you know, a lot of pain or sadness or something. Do you want to tell me about your feelings, how you felt yesterday? And at four, he may or may not remember that happened.
Yeah, that's true.
But having said that, I think, yeah, but I actually, he may not remember it, but I do think there is something to be said about there is still an emotional imprinting that happens as a child. We know it because if we look back to our memories, we remember the things that were hard. And when I say that, I just want you to know that I have not met anyone who has not had a moment like that with their kids. And if you have been one of those people, let me know. But I have not met that
person. That's
why
I'm not ashamed to share it on this platform, because I feel like I'm an open book. Right. And whatever I'm saying, I'm sure many people are like, oh, I felt that. And as you were talking about the two different voices inside of us, one being ashamed of it, like, but it's good that you're saying that, and and so we know we're not alone. So definitely. And you know, we 100%. Have to recognize it in order to move forward and make it different. Like you were saying with the parents. I mean, no, I remember growing up, like if I fell, right? Like by accident, I fell. My father would get so like angry. I think in his mind, he was like scared that we could have hurt ourselves, but his reaction was to yell, why did you do that? So like, it's this like thing of like, I'm afraid to fall or, you know, hurt myself because, you know, he's going to get mad. But so a lot of that stuff, I'm sure it comes back later. So I want to make sure to fix it now so that my son doesn't have those issues when he is older, you know, yelling at his kid. Lord knows he's going to get hurt enough. So I don't want to be yelling at him every time he gets hurt. But there also is a stage of just stubbornness in children about 4 or 5 years old, I would imagine, too, right? That, like, they want power.
Well, different kids,
they want power. There's, like, a power struggle going on between the parent and the child. And how do we know if this is a power struggle that we should be, you know, keep give them a little bit of power so they can have some? I mean, do you recommend that?
Do you know, when you're saying, or you're framing it that way, it is the way I would have framed it way back when, but now I don't actually see it the same way. What I see is that we have our unique autonomy. Like we have an internal locus of control, like right from the get-go, right from the beginning, we have a sense of, yeah, this is me. No, mommy, I don't want that. And not all kids will say it out loud. Some kids will be very compliant. They're the easy ones. And I had those at four too, but mostly the other ones. But the compliant ones or the the ones that challenge us, they all just want to feel like they have a place of autonomy or separateness inside of them. And I think it comes across for us, we see it as it's a representation of conflict or contrariness. And I know that sometimes the parenting world can portray it that way. And I certainly saw it that way. But if, just take it as an example, even if you don't see it the way that I do, if you perceive your child as having an internal autonomy and they just want to assert themselves and have some independence and do things their own way, even though they'll make mistakes all over the place and do things that could potentially dry them out in the sun, they're not doing something against us. It is very hard to see that at times, very, very difficult to see that as not a confrontation or not a power struggle. But I can guarantee that if you go into, I'm fighting you on this thing, and no, you can't do this, and let me fight you on this, they will return the favor and you will go back and forth. So what I've learned, and I've learned that the hard way too, but what I've learned is that you have to decide inside yourself what is important, has to happen, and we're doing it anyway. And so then you confidently, assertively just say, this is what we're doing, without reactions, which is a very long, lifelong goal for some of us who've had those real big emotional stuff in our families, but not reacting, because when they see those reactions, they see it or perceive it as contrary, and they will react. They will play that power game, and you don't want to get into that push-pull energy with your kids if you can practice that.
Well, that makes sense.
So it might not be.
I know the little booger didn't want to bring the water to bike club because he doesn't have a little attachment on his bike to keep the water bottle in. So we have to give the water bottle to the coach. And I thought about it after, and I was like, that little booger, he wants to be one of the cool kids with an attachment on his bike. But he didn't, whether he didn't want to ask or didn't know that that's why he didn't want to bring the water, but I thought about it after, and I was like, is it just because you, so I'm like, well, you know what, you have birthday money or whatever money, you can, we'll go to Walmart and you can go find an attachment. But you're right. There is something in them. It might not necessarily be a power struggle. There's a reason that they can't verbalize or don't think that there's a need to verbalize. You know, he was just saying to me, I don't need water.
At that age. Yeah. It's, mm-hmm. If you're talking about like a 14, 15 year old or something, something else might be going on. And not to put on a certain level of like all the responsibility on the parent. However, sometimes our kids really just want to feel connected and attached to us. And sometimes they're bidding for that attachment in unpalatable ways. So sometimes they're, and I wouldn't say at four, by the way, not typically, but at an older age that maybe they're accustomed to being told, this is how we do it, we have to do this, or these are all the things we have to do in the day. And so going through the motions, but if they're not feeling like there's a deep sense of connection, they might not even be able to verbalize what I just said. But if they don't have that deep sense of connection or attachment, then they're less likely to come alongside your intentions or your values.
So is that something that you were conscious of the whole time you were homeschooling, this like being aware of these things, or did it come to you? You were an RN, so didn't have this training early on.
No, I also have that memoir, unpublished memoir. So I think that has informed me more than anything, which has not been an advantage. I've had to work through all the tricky journeys of this. What I'm speaking to today, no, absolutely not. I have not figured this out way back when.
Now, your kids, did they have a big community of like friends they could socialize with growing up? Was in British Columbia, what is there a big homeschooling community there?
So we're a lot smaller in scale than the States. So I'd say, is it 10 to 1? I should not do math. We have a lot fewer people than you. But it's not huge. Certainly not high school where I am. That's definitely not a thing. And I live 20 minutes outside a small town on a homestead. But we haven't always lived here. So we've done a lot of traveling for 7 years. And so we built community wherever we went, or, made connections wherever we went. I learned very quickly in homeschooling, first of all, that the S question, I call it the S question, socialization, is moot. It is not relevant. If you've been homeschooling for long enough, you realize that you could easily be constantly in social opportunity mode with your kids and never do anything intentionally learning, although they'll still learn. But you're always exposed to other people and in far more, many different areas, like, adults and young kids and all across the spectrum. You experience it all over the place. Differently than you would in a school. But when it comes to community, I learned you have to make community, and you also have to accept people that don't always see the world the same way that you do. Because we homeschool families are very independent minded, and we grow in that as we continue. In the beginning years, I was very conscious of how people weren't seeing things the same way as me. And clearly that's not the case anymore, because I'm just saying what is true for me, whether I'm always right or not is besides the point. Internally, I'm speaking what's true and authentic here. And I don't think about what other people are thinking about my choices. But I have really learned that in the beginning years, you have to be very intentional about creating community in various ways so that you can do things outside of, you're just going to meet a lot of people that are not doing things the same way that you're doing them. So you have to be intentional about building it.
And as they've gotten older, do you, Let's see, I guess, do you see, what sort of differences do you see in your kids versus if you have like nieces and nephews that did go to, you know, a typical school institution?
Yeah. Okay. So I tend to not want to compare systems to systems because I don't want to slag what other people are doing, because there's some really amazing families that have their kids in school. So I've noticed, and yet I have noticed that typically homeschool kids are very comfortable relating to very young people, much older people, people they've never met before. They assume that they can have a conversation with anybody and anybody will listen because mom is listening or dad is listening at home to the kids. They are used to feeling heard and seen. And so there's less hierarchy in how they approach people. They just assume that they'll be seen or heard. I certainly see, though, that, as I said earlier, they expect that there's a reason for why people are doing what they're doing or expecting what they're expecting. And I do see them thinking in their own worlds how they believe about certain things rather than what the people or group around them thinks. And part of that, I think, is attachment, that they've been attached. And also part of it is that they're watching us as homeschool families live our lives on our own terms. And so that's really a useful thing for human beings to have those things inside of them as, you know, young people. But here's what I've learned too, is that when you teach your kids to do that, to think for themselves, it means they're not always thinking the way you're thinking. And they will not always align their values, or maybe not values, their values are similar, but the precise things, like if we have a conversation about anything, they may not see things the same way.
Yeah. And that's good though. That's why, you know, we homeschool.
It is good, but it's hard to adjust to.
Now, do you have rules around screen time, and have you, as they were growing up?
Yep.
How does that go over?
Yes, I have. Well, you know, it's very dependent on the kiddo. And you're living in a different parenting in a different generation, really, than I am. Because when my oldest was 3, I think they did have, yeah, we had computers and there were games. And I remember one mom, a friend that I had, her 3-year-old was allowed to use screens. And I just desperately wanted my very active 3-year-old to please sit down and be quiet for an hour. So I'd have gladly taken a screen, but she didn't want to anyway. I would say that I don't do strict rules for this is what has to happen at a certain time anymore. The older they get, the more challenging it gets. As a principal, just note that as soon as the first child gets their independent screen, everything else changes in the home. And I am a strong proponent of limiting screens, but not for the reasons most people talk about. I do wonder in the back of my head, this is purely my opinion, that the increased rise of ADHD diagnoses is maybe related to increased screen time, because there's a really increased ADHD thing going on. But that's just pure guess. And I think it's valuable to limit screens so that we, when we need time alone and separate time, they really want to go to that screen and you can really get quiet time. And so that's one of the reasons. I also think they're extremely useful tools. They are extremely useful tools, but it's also useful for your kids to be bored sometimes, because boredom in tinier amounts, like they shouldn't spend their entire childhood being bored. But the thing is, I don't know that that's possible, because they get bored, they get creative, and they do some really cool things. So that's the reasons why I tend to limit screen time.
And I've heard that before too. Boredom creates creativity. You know, you don't think to go, you know, build this or, you know, work on these crafts and build that unless you're bored enough to think of the things to do, which is huge. And I agree with you on the ADHD thing. When you just think of it in simple terms of you're sitting stagnant in front of a screen, you're not running around. Now, maybe if every time you sat in front of a screen for a half hour, you then spend a half hour running outside, or, you know, vice versa, one before the other, maybe maybe the ADHD wouldn't be on the rise. It might not be an actual correlation of what the screen's doing, but the sitting is, you know, the sitting for any length of time is definitely causing us where, you know, we have to be active. So that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I do find it hard because, you know, sometimes you do just need that little bit of time to make dinner or, you know, do the dishes, do the laundry. And
yeah.
My kid's not huge into the screens, mostly because I don't really know how to operate the iPad. So there's only like two games he can play. In fact, I think we got a subscription.
And yet you're producing a podcast.
Oh,
impressive.
My goodness. It's, well, because they have it where like you have to sign on to the parent account to add games. But like, yeah. I don't know, he had YouTube on there and all of a sudden there was like this transgender person popped up on an ad. And my husband's like, what is he watching? And I'm like, I don't know. It came up on YouTube. He was watching like, I don't know, Hudson's Playground. This kid that him and his dad are all on, doing all the things that we do at home here, but for whatever reason, I'm sure everybody can relate, when somebody does it on the screen, your kid's interested. So, yeah, and then they have these crazy ads popping up.
I think screens are overrated. I remember when internet came into the world, because I was that many years, and I remember us being given an email in college and me thinking, this is such a waste of time. Like, I could just go see this person on Wednesday, or I could call them with a phone. This is going to be like such a waste of my college years. And now I'm like, no, it turns out still have
crazy. You know. I know my mom was a secretary for the state. Like, her whole job was opening up mail and like doing what needed to be done, filing it away,
or
responding with a typewriter. And like, I just, yeah.
Yes. I was good on a typewriter, 90 words per minute. Yeah, no, times have changed, but I think there's obviously stuff on there that we don't value or that we don't want our kids to see, or that we just think they're too young for this to understand or process something or whatever, but I don't think the screens are always that valuable. I do think that real time in nature, real time living life and getting curious about things is valuable, but you know, I don't know. Maybe that's because I'm almost 50 and that's a sign of my generation.
Well, it's scary. It's scary times. You know, the computers are helpful for so many things. Like, even we were out in nature and, you know, we saw a little robin building her nest because, you know, she was getting ready to lay her eggs. Yeah. And it was, I was like, hey, let's go and see what videos we can find on how the birds build the nest and, you know, that whole process. Ironically, there aren't that many great ones. So if anyone, I found one, but it wasn't a robin. But it is very interesting on how the birds, you know, even get their feet going to make the nest. I mean, it's crazy.
Yes.
But to learn how long it takes and that, you know, I don't know if is it the male that makes it? Well, at least for some of the birds, the male makes it. And if the female doesn't like it, she'll kick it to the ground or something. But all that stuff is so interesting. And So to go out in nature to find something to even be interested about, and then you take it back inside or even, you know, use your computer outside to research it. It's got so many great values. But then when you get into the, you know, you're just kind of get mesmerized. And then I'm sure there is, in all the kids movies and kids shows that I watch now, I see the subliminal messaging. So it's really, I mean, it is not an easy time to parent. I know that we're not like, you know, having to carry water, you know, to and fro outside just so we could take a shower. So I'm thankful for that. But it's such a different times in just a generation or two.
Yeah, you actually bring that up. And that does, like, we traveled quite a bit for 7 years. So this was when we were in rural Kenya, the first time we went to Africa. And so there was a time where my sister was calling and we were just chatting and then discovered that I had no water. And they actually had no water on the compound. So there was no water available at all because the electricity was down and it wasn't working with the pump, water pump. And so then I said, what are we going to do? I don't know what we're going to do. And maybe we're just gonna have to go down the mountain and get water from down at the base of the mountain. And it turns out people in the hospital compound were ready to do that, but that is what they did for us. They brought water, and it was like a 2.5-3 hour journey on foot to get water. It was an unbelievable experience. But what I learned from that and many other moments when I was overseas is that we have a very soft life here. It's pretty comfortable. Even our hardest stuff, like I'm not saying that our hardest stuff can't be pretty hard. It absolutely can. And also, collectively, we have a pretty easy life.
I mean, you talk to teenagers or, you know, young adults today, and they don't think we have it that way in America. Like, I definitely think that that is put in their minds by social media, television, movies, you know, propaganda, that sort of stuff. What would the people in Africa say, you know, about what, or even in British Columbia, about what the state of affairs, especially in America these days?
What would they say? Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure. What are you referring to?
Like, are they kind of like, I mean, we're over here in public schools worrying about if there's, like, you know, cat litter boxes because, you know, these kids want to say that they're cats today and we're going to go with it because free expression. And they're over, they're like, we don't always have running water. These are big issues.
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting that you say that because I obviously am not going to be able to represent the continent of Africa, which is a lot of people. But my experience when I was there is that, first of all, we didn't need to bring the things we thought we did. I have had my own disillusionment with things like the Samaritan's Purse boxes that we would send every Christmas for years because they don't care about that stuff. Like, it's not that valuable. Healthcare resources or pencils and papers are useful in some areas. And then soccer balls are always valued. That was what I learned.
How
soccer funny. Balls. Yeah, they're
just
amazing.
Just because they like playing?
Yeah.
Or do they have another purpose? Yeah.
They play and they play well. Yeah, and they really play. But I think we have a much more materialistic place to live. So, you know, we're very comfortable. And yet, I mean, they have concerns. You know, when I'm sitting with my husband in pediatric rounds and he's assessing kids, your kids' age, for malaria, cerebral malaria, and, you know, they're lined up with their mothers in the lineup. And then there was one little girl, a baby that was brought into the lineup who did not look alive. And my husband assessed the baby and did it very slowly because he could see that she was not alive. And then how is he going to make sure to engage this, you know, the discussion in an appropriate way, not say she's not alive when maybe she is. But anyways, you know, having moments like that, I felt like bursting into tears. I felt overwhelmed in the moment thinking this is horrible. And that's not how everybody was engaging, at least not externally. They were fairly stoic. And clearly see that level of lack of health a lot more than we ever do. And I don't know, they're just made, me representing a group of people is both absurd on one hand, but also they're just made of such strength, perhaps because they've had so much more challenge than we have. But I can't say what, you know, how they would actually respond to what's going on in this part of the world.
Yeah.
Can't say that.
I mean, I can imagine that people, like, there's real concerns, you know, like the health of your baby. And, you know, it's just some of the stuff that we're worried about here. And
we kind of take it for
granted.
Exactly.
Now, what made you go abroad? Was it for your husband's job and work and humanitarian services?
Yeah, it's sharing. At core, it was sharing and adventure, both at the same time. We connected in with someone. Well, I mean, I had years ago hoped to do that. You'll see that in my high school yearbook that I wanted to have 10 kids and marry my Patrick Swayze. My husband doesn't dance with Patrick Swayze. But, and then go to Africa. And I just always was fascinated. And so that was me initially. And I was nursing, so I was planning to do that. But at this time I was homeschooling, so we were taking the kids over and we just really wanted to share. That was the goal, and it was amazing. Just so many different levels. It was amazing for us specifically. It definitely did open our eyes to, you know, when you speak about diversity or inclusivity, for me, it just speaks to, like, I had this one conversation with one mom that was a bit younger than me, but had kids on the same years that I did, and had a husband who essentially was an equivalent to a medical doctor. And she had the same goals in life as me. She lived in a very different scenario than me, but she wanted happiness for her kids and everybody to be healthy. She wanted to contribute to the community. And it really did show me that I think the world over, though we may be very different in some elements or think differently about things, at core, a lot of the times we want the same things.
Oh, absolutely. We're all humans, you know, and want what's best for our children. And, you know, I think we're all just on this journey to find that.
What
are some of the biggest takeaways that you got from coming from your work overseas and seeing your children kind of learning in that environment?
Yeah, that was, I mean, I had one of my biggest lessons I had was with a 16-year-old boy in Ghana. He was in shock and awe that I didn't know the history of Ghana, or that they were no longer under colonial rule until, I think, 1964. And he was in shock that I didn't know that. And we had a very interesting conversation. And I showed him pictures of snow, something he didn't know anything about. He thought it was hilarious that I thought it was hot because it was their winter. You know, it was really interesting to have a conversation with him. And for me, it made it very clear that the world over, we all have educational gaps, just like you were saying before. We all do. And what I value in, certain knowledge bits, what I think are important as knowledge bits might not be what somebody else thinks. Certainly each province and state and country values different things. But when I had that moment with him, I thought, there it is. He knows stuff I don't, and I know stuff he doesn't. And that's just the way it is.
Going back to kind of what we were talking about, like, what do you need to know by the end of first grade? What do you need to know by the end of high school? It's like, well, there's not a set thing. It's just what you feel is valuable for your child to know. And clearly you're both making it through life just fine without one not knowing without what snow is and the other not knowing the history of Ghana. And isn't it weird that our education system in America doesn't teach us the history of Ghana? You know, like, why is it just they didn't feel that we need it? Or, you know, or for most places, honestly, because I didn't learn very much other than wars or maybe like the Incas, Mayans, you know, we didn't learn.
Yeah. Aztecs over here. I learned about the Aztecs.
I learned that it was very boring learning about it, but it's probably not. It's probably very interesting.
Not anymore. Yeah. Now as an adult, I find it interesting for sure.
Yeah. There's just so much. How many times did you go over to Africa?
2 times in different rural areas. Yeah. And it was, you know, in some ways, in essence, I'd have to say that the second time we went, it was actually in the Ebola crisis. And we were going on that side of the, you know, the part of Africa with our 4 kids. And it took us quite a few months to come to terms with, is this a really good idea or is this really unwise? And we came to understand that it wouldn't be high risk. When we actually were there, we discovered that no, actually the people there thought it was high risk. And I got malaria, obviously no Ebola. I have so many thoughts about that. Some are, that was crazy. Why were we there? Another one is, it just opens up my eyes. I'm sure it opens up my kids' eyes to really seeing people more openly than maybe we thought before. Like, I'm not looking at people based on, you know, where they come from, and I know that it influences how I experience people, but I am able to really ask people, who are you? What do you value? And really listen to people in a way that I hadn't before.
Yeah. I mean, when I think about, you know, our country, America, it's, and what do I want my children to know for the future? It's like, okay, well, I'd like them to know how to live self-sustainably. If they couldn't get food or something at the grocery store. If, you know, when we think about living self-sustainably, we kind of are brought up to be like, well, if you don't need government assistance, you know, like welfare or food stamps, but really living self-sustainably is, do you need the government to put food on the shelves at the grocery store, you know, or electricity in your house or water in your well or, you know, to your house? And can we live, you know, can we find ways to be able to do that? Because even if we don't need it in my lifetime, it doesn't mean that my children's children or their children won't need it. And if it's lost, if those arts are lost in just one generation, they're never, you know, how hard will it be to get them back? And so that's why I think that's important to me.
Do you homestead yourself?
No, but I'd love to. I have my book behind me here, Polyface Micro from Joel Salatin. I'm currently reading. That was the most like educational thing I could put behind me to look like I'm smart. But that I would love to homestead as part of our homeschooling process and journey. I mean, I got chickens, which is, you know, I've kept them alive for 2 years.
Nice.
So we're doing good. We're on a slow process to homesteading. thank you so much for meeting with me today. It has been such a pleasure talking to you. And I will put the links to your sites. If you send those to me, I will put them right in the show's description so that people can find you.
Delightful. Yeah, that'd be great. It was a real pleasure to connect with you today.
All right. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Homeschool How-To. If you've enjoyed what you heard, please consider helping me out by sharing this podcast with friends, with your homeschool community, and even to your favorite homeschool group Facebook page. As a new podcast, we're really trying to get our episodes out there so that we can keep going. Also, if you'd like to be a guest on the show and tell us about your homeschooling experience, email me at thehomeschoolhowto@gmail.com or visit thehomeschoolhowto.com and send me a message through Facebook or Instagram. Thank you for your time and for your love of the next generation. We'll see you next week.